Thank you, Laurie. Let me get this computer open. It's not my machine, so hopefully I can. And is the this mic working still? I'm afraid all the $1 coins I got from the Metro is short-circuiting the wireless. It's nice to see you, Laurie, but it reminds me of the years during General Reno's administration that we worked together and helped bringing research and evidence-based research back to the Attorney General. And Chris Rose, I will tell you that she was a graduate student of mine many years ago. I won't say when because I think that's impolite. But I remember, though, that it was her second day in our graduate program was the day my 25-year-old son was born. But I won't tell you when she was there. Okay. And I taught her research methods. So I'm so glad to hear you talk about research-based evidence-based research. So I have to get this up here now, right? Okay. Great, it works. I'm here to talk for a few minutes, basically about a report that I released back in December on the surge of homicide involving young black males with guns. This report, by the way, was not funded by NIJ, unfortunately, and I know there's some NIJ people here who could certainly correct the fact that this wasn't. It was funded, actually, it was supported by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, a series of grants from them, as well as the American Statistical Association's Committee on Law and Justice. Of course, the opinions are mine. I released this report that, because I've been tracking for several years a rise in homicide among young black males. You know, because we've been hearing so much wonderful news about crime rates going down, homicide down. Of course, the 2007 UCR talked about a 1.3% decline in homicide, and just the other day, June 1st, we heard from the preliminary numbers for 2008 that homicide's down 4.4%. Although it's preliminary, I know Washington, D.C. is not in there, a few other cities, so we will see when the finals come out. And the impression you get, of course, is that things are wonderful. We're a 30-year low in homicide, and homicide continues to decline. And we hear in the press, when they analyze all the numbers, that the violence is down across the board. Now, of course, the board that the FBI uses and the UCR is broken down by regions of the country and different population groups. Their board does not include demography. And when you look very closely in terms of breakdowns by age, race, and gender, you see a very different picture. And it's not down across the board. Essentially, what we have is a divergent tale of two communities. We have a declining rate, homicide rate, continuing to decline among the prosperous in their safe communities, and we have a surging rate of violence, particularly homicide, particularly gun homicide, among the poor. And the important part about this is that every time we hear the great news about crime rates going down, it's just not consistent with the experiences of some Americans who are living and perhaps even dying in neighborhoods of Boston and Philadelphia and Baltimore, Washington, Detroit, and elsewhere. Those experiences are not represented in these data because, of course, they are overshadowed in the aggregate. Now, what we essentially see is that when you look closely among young black males, we indeed have more at-risk youngsters with guns in their hands and gangs in their plans. And in fact, over the five-year period of time from 2002 to 2007, the number of murders by and against young black males has surged, 43% increase in the number of victims, black male teenagers, and a 47% increase in perpetrators. Of course, the reason those are so similar is that typically young black males are killing other young black males. And I will focus on homicide, not just because it's the name of this panel, but because we have the best data on homicide in terms of detail. But it probably is a much tip of a much larger iceberg of gun violence, not just homicide. Now, the Attorney General last February, as you know, was criticized for during Black History Month, talking about us as a nation of cowards, that we're afraid to discuss very delicate issues of race. And I agree with them. And actually, my own experience with this report is that when I was about to release this report about the surge in homicide of young black males, many of my colleagues said, don't do it. They'll call you a racist. Just don't do it. And I did, in fact, pre-release this report to the press about 10 days in advance of the embargo date, and they did their usual checking of other criminologists and what do they think about it. And several reporters came back to me and said, you know, we talked to lots of criminologists who said, they know this is true, but they will not go on the record and talk about the surge in homicide among young black males. They just don't want to do that. We're willing to talk about race and sentencing, race and convictions, race and incarceration, race and race stops. Car stops. But we're not so willing to talk about race and violence rates. Some people, perhaps, are afraid of being misquoted or taken out of context, or the whole problem of sound bites. But it's something that we need to address and not overlook. And what's interesting is when the report finally did come out, the most positive response I did receive was from the black community. Not just the press, although that was quite interesting. I'm a white guy, as you can see, and no one confused me with the other Jamie Foxx. So the greatest response was from journalists like Gary Fields at the Wall Street Journal, or columnists like Clarence Page, and black leaders around the country, because essentially this is something that many Americans know is happening. They see it in their streets, in their communities, but the statistics just haven't recognized it. So this is evidence-based, obviously. It's not just some white guy spewing out ideas. It's all based on numbers, and the numbers confirm the experience of many Americans that crime rates are not down across the board. Now, let's look at some data. I don't want to overdo too many numbers here. You know, this early in the morning, an overdose of statistics is called math murder, and I don't want to do that. But you can see that these are the percentage change in murder rates. There has been a nearly 10% increase among males, a 20% increase among young males, teenage males, over a 40% increase among young black males, and when you throw guns into the mix, the increase in 5 years has been nearly 50%. And I will tell you, by the way, just for the researchers in this room, these are offenders. And through funding from the Bureau of Statistics and the American Statistical Association, I've gone through a process of multiple imputation, filling in the data that are missing, particularly on the unsolved homicides. So these are estimates. These are both known offenders and reasonable estimates of unsolved homicides and the characteristics of the perpetrators that we believe committed them. That is, for example, if a 14-year-old black male committed a homicide, I'm sorry, if a 14-year-old black male is a victim of a homicide and it's unsolved, we can pretty much be sure that it's not an 80-year-old white female who committed it. So we can go through the process of imputation, and these numbers are imputed when they're not available. But as you see, we have this surge. Now, there wasn't a complete 100% positive response in the press. The sole negative came from Stephen Levitt and his New York Times blog, Mr. Freak, the Freak Economist. And he indeed suggested that, well, you know, I was talking about numbers, number of killers, and it's all a matter of population growth. And he repeated the New York Times did a graphic based on my data, and you can see there the surge among black youth and the level among white youth. And he said, well, that's just because of population growth, as you can see in his comments in blue. Well, that's actually not quite the case, because the 11.5% increase over the 5-year period of time in the number of black male 14 to 17-year-olds cannot account for an over 40% increase in the number of perpetrators. I understand his point. In the long term, you want to adjust for population size. But in the short term, it doesn't matter that much. And it's very important that we not, you know, oftentimes we talk about rates per 100,000, and we lose sight of the fact that these are people. You know, that hundreds of more people are being murdered 1 year to the next. And when you put it all into rates, it just doesn't sound like These are human lives that are being lost. So it's important not to lose fact of the idea that there are 350 more young black males being murdered in 2007 than in 2002. And indeed, if you do calculate rates, the rates basically look very similar to the volumes. That's about a third increase, but it's one-third increase in the rate in five-year period of time is hardly something to ignore. Now, also Stephen Levitt said, I was alarmist. You know, I'm overstating the case, just trying to get some media attention. Well, I was trying to get media attention. I did do this press release and embargoed the report to the day after Christmas weekend to get the most play, but for a purpose, to get people's attention. And he claimed that I sort of ignored the fact that things are really not that bad. If you go back to the bad old days of 1990, things were much worse. Well, it wasn't my report. In fact, he took this figure right out of my report, put it on his blog to show the fact that there was this peak back in 1990s. We all remember those bad days. And he's suggesting that what's happening today is nothing, nothing compared to back then. Well, I agree that things are a lot better in 2007 or 8 or 9, notwithstanding the increase we've seen in the last few years. But they're a lot worse than they were in 2000. And why wait around and see if we'll get back to the point or even close to the point we were back in 1990 and do nothing now about it? Now, I mentioned guns, too, because guns are an important part of the change. As you can see here, the homicides by teenagers involving guns represents the entire growth since 2000. There has been no increase at all in the number of homicides committed with other weapons by teenagers. And then when you break it down again by race and gender, you see there in the red at the rate of killing by young black males per 100,000, if you want rates, with guns has surged. And that's the 50%, almost 50% I talked about before. In percentage terms, we are now at a record high peak in terms of the percentage of homicides that involve guns among young black males. It's now up to 85%. By the way, it's the percentage of homicides among white adults involving guns has continued to decline, as you can see there in the yellow line, the one I took at D.C. yesterday, the yellow line. It's down now to about 50%. So, but important, we look at the red, that we made progress in the 1990s. Well, of course, we had the Brady Law, and we had the assault weapons ban. We had the ATF gun tracing initiative to identify the rogue dealers that were supplying the guns to the youth crime market. We had a variety of lawsuits in New York, Boston, California, basically to try to get the gun industry to shape up in terms of their advertising and business practices. And all those things worked. We did indeed see in the 1990s a decline in the percentage of homicides involving guns among all segments of the population across the board. But since 2000, now that we have the Tihard Amendment, which restricts the use of gun tracing data, now that we have Congress passing the immunity law, protecting the gun industry from lawsuits. Who knew when they talked about tort reform back in the 2000 election that we meant, oh, just the gun industry. That's what we're really talking about. So, and then who knows what will happen in years ahead post-Heller. So there is reason for concern that we've taken steps backwards in terms of the issue of guns. And, you know, a gun in the hand of a teenager is a very deadly mix. Though he may not be trained in using that firearm, he's much more likely to be trigger happy, much more likely to pull the trigger over seemingly trivial issues. And therein lies the problem. So we have to get back to what we were doing in the 1990s in terms of guns, without violating the Second Amendment, of course, which none of that did. Now, the issue of the comeback of the gang problem, it's hard to measure because the most unreliable part of the supplementary homicide reports are the circumstance codes. This is an understatement, an undercount. And by the way, these are not imputed. So we're not really sure what percentage of homicides now involve gangs. But certainly there seems to have been a resurgence in gang activity. And we know when you stop paying much attention to a problem, it rebounds. You know, we don't solve the gang problem. I'm sorry, we don't control the gang problem. I'm sorry, we don't solve the gang problem, we control it. And when you stop paying so much attention to it, it rebounds. And many cities, like mine, like Boston and other cities, which had very successful efforts in the 1990s in dealing with gangs in their cities, once we reached about 2000 and the gang problem seemed to go away, a lot of those resources were cut. A lot of those anti-gang initiatives were cut. And we are, of course, seeing the results of it. You know, there's lots of talk about summer and the fact that there are very few jobs out there for youth. Well, that may be, but gangs are always hiring. Gangs are always recruiting. And what we have to understand about gangs is that there's lots of positive reasons why kids join gangs. They join gangs to feel special. It's thrilling. It's exciting. They get praised, camaraderie, belonging to something important. And most of all, is that gangs offer them opportunity. It doesn't matter what color their skin is. It doesn't matter if they went to Penn or not. I buy 4 degrees at Penn, a quadruple Quaker. Doesn't matter where they went to college. You can rise right to the top of the gang. All you have to do is be loyal, fierce, go right to the top. So, of course, part of the reason, and what we have to do is continue to find ways that kids can fulfill the same needs without gang membership. I'm a big fan of Boys and Girls Clubs of America. I should plug them since I've worked with them for several years. The kind of work that they do, the after-school programs that we worked on so much through the Clinton years, were so vitally important in keeping kids safe off the streets and out of gangs. And it's time to go get back to those kind of initiatives. A lot of the concern, of course, is, well, the reason why gangs is an issue is that parents aren't doing their job. And gangs are becoming a substitute family. And Bill Cosby, of course, ruffled lots of feathers back in 2008 when he talked about problems in the black family. The president, when he was campaigning about a year ago on Father's Day, made some very bold statements about black fathers who are missing in action and AWOL. Well, that's quite true, and there are many parents, perhaps, who are negligent and don't really care. But many parents are well-meaning and would like to have a greater role in the upbringing of their kids. What we need to do is to assist parents, not assail them. I have no idea what that says. How many minutes? I'm out of time. I'm almost done. Okay? Great. I really am. I've got only a couple more. I'm actually ending with this. Things are bad, and I don't want to say that they're, I don't want to be an alarmist and say they're out of control, because they're not. Things are a lot better than they were before. But the potential does exist for things to get worse. In terms of the gun issue I mentioned, in terms of the cuts that we've seen in policing, 10% decline in per capita policing in major cities of this country over the past 7 years, cuts in after-school programs, cuts in all sorts of youth prevention programs. So the conditions are there to make me worry. In addition to that, if you look ahead, demography is not on our side. We will have more at-risk youth. This is the number of children under the age of 5 projected in the years ahead, broken down by race. Not much of an increase in the number of white kids, but black kids and Latino kids, large increases in the years ahead. Now, these kids are under 5. They're not out there committing crimes. But, you know, they get a year older every year. I know that's true because I teach statistics. And it won't be long till these kids who are under 5 become 10 and 15. We did a very good job at dealing with the last generation of teenagers in the 1990s, but they don't pass along the message. You can't just say we've accomplished that because we get a new group of teenagers every 5 years. We have to continue that effort. So let me conclude by saying, summarizing what you have there, I'll really focus on the fact that obviously economic times are tough. We all know that. But, you know, you can't tell an 8-year-old, hey, wait till the recession's over. We'll get back to you. I know you got issues that we need to deal with. We just don't have the money. Wait till the recession's over. An 8-year-old can't wait. He's going to be 9 and 10 and 11 very soon. And it's important that we reach them now when they're young and impressionable and will be impressed by what a preacher, a teacher, or some other authority figure has to say. It's better that we prehabilitate these kids rather than rehabilitate. So money's tight, but we found the resources to bail out the banks and to bail out the car industry. Maybe we need a bailout for at-risk youth. Really, the choice is ours. Either pay for these programs now or pray for the victims later. Thank you very much.